The natural world has taken on a new edge where something we can't even see appears to be attacking us. When we talk about confronting the COVID-19 virus, it's with metaphors of war and battle. The president said we are fighting an invisible enemy, an evil beast. And yet we have to understand that the virus is doing what all living things do naturally, reproducing as much as it can. We don't know exactly how this novel coronavirus first infected humans, but scientists have done a lot of work to understand where these viruses came from in the first place. Staff writer Carolyn Corman talked recently with someone who searches out coronaviruses in their natural habitat.
So first, could you just tell us who you are, your name, and your job, and what you do, and how you hunt viruses?
Sure. My name is John Epstein. I'm a disease ecologist with EcoHealth Alliance in New York, which is a nonprofit science-based organization that studies epidemics and tries to figure out how they happen and how to stop them. So the job that I do, the research that I do, is specifically on zoonotic viruses. Those are viruses that are carried by animals and jump into people or spread into people. Viruses like Ebola, SARS coronavirus, the current SARS coronavirus 2 that's causing COVID-19. And one thing that these viruses have in common is that they're carried by different types of bats. And so I've spent a lot of my career working with different bat species and trying to understand the viruses that they carry.
So, as I understand it, back in 2004, you got on a plane to China to track down the first SARS virus, which is a relative of the current coronavirus. Where would you go? I mean, how did you decide which bat caves to visit and which markets to visit? And what was the experience like? How did you do the work?
Well, the markets where SARS emerged were in the major cities. And so we wanted to start near there, figuring that the animals probably most likely came from the surrounding area, and then we'd work our way outwards. And about 2 or 3 hours drive out of the city, you get to farmland. But there are these enormous and beautiful limestone mountains or hills, and limestone formations are great for having caves. Some of them were, long and tortuous, maybe 10 feet high at the ceiling, tunnels that were going into big caverns. And sometimes these caverns would open up and they were the size of airplane hangars.
Wow.
And so we were in these enormous caverns. And the way that we catch bats is that we set up nets. And the nets are typically like a volleyball net that's strung between two masts or two poles. They could be bamboo poles. We were hand carrying these in. And then we also had hand nets that look like big butterfly nets. And sometimes you can get close enough to bats that they're hanging on the ceiling that you can simply catch them with a butterfly type net. So the trick was to position our net in a flyway that would be heavily trafficked, congested, where lots of bats were flying through and that just simply couldn't avoid the net, even if they saw it.
And about how many bats, though, are there in the cave? I mean, are hundreds of thousands?
Or? Yeah, there could be thousands, tens of thousands. It really varied on the size of the cave and the species. We would go in during the day. Bats would tend to be sleeping on the ceiling. But of course, once you're in there and disturb them, they fly around.
Mm.
What we did was we would go into the caves and we would set up a sampling station.
Hmm. And so you take, in effect, nasal swabs when you're taking samples?
No, not we take a oropharyngeal or oral swab. So we use tiny little pediatric-sized cotton swabs that can fit into the bat's mouth and ideally into the back of its throat. And that's where we rub it a little bit, let the bat chew on it, and try to collect saliva that way.
Huh.
And then bats will often help us out by providing a little fecal pellet when we catch them or put them into bags when we catch them. And so then we get a fecal sample. And on rare occasion, depending on the bat and the size of the bat, we might even get a urine sample. And then we collect blood from veins on the arm of the bat. We're able to collect tiny amounts of blood, and then we release the animal right on site.
And what would you think about when you held the bats in your hand?
Well, I love working with bats. I love working with animals in general. I've worked with the largest bats in the world, which is the Malayan flying fox in Malaysia, which is a giant fruit bat that has about a 5-foot wingspan, weighs about 2 pounds. It's like a flying chihuahua or a flying squirrel. But they're adorable animals. You know, they have a sort of fox-like head, and these are very social animals, very charismatic animals. Their temperament can vary. Some of them can be very feisty and bitey. Others can be very docile. Smaller insect-eating bats, they range from the really tiny to about the size of your thumb to a little bit bigger, maybe the size of the palm of your hand.
And what did you discover from hunting down the first SARS virus? What does it tell us about, you know, this its cousin or this new coronavirus?
It was really interesting. At the time, we didn't know which species we were going to find anything in or if we'd find anything at all. And after testing a lot of different bats, it turned out that horseshoe bats, which is an insect-eating group of bats, we were carrying a virus that was closely related to SARS. And in fact, it looked to be ancestral. So what that told us was that we had kind of found a progenitor virus, one from which SARS likely came. And that was the first clue that bats were probably a natural reservoir for these viruses.
How does the virus get from a bat into another animal? You know, how does the virus kind of jump this species barrier?
Well, different viruses have different abilities to infect one or more hosts. What happens is some viruses use a certain strategy for getting inside of cells, and they need to get inside of cells in the body to hijack the cell's machinery and make more virus. And they have there's what's called a receptor on the cell surface that a virus uses, like a lock and key, where the virus might have the key and it needs a specific lock that certain cells might have. SARS and SARS coronavirus 2, which causes COVID-19, use a receptor called the ACE2 receptor, which is found in a lot of mammals. It's conserved across mammals, including people. And we have ACE2 receptors in the cells in our lower lungs, which is why we get a lower respiratory disease when infected with SARS-CoV-2. And we also have some ACE2 receptors in our intestinal cells. So we know that SARS and SARS-CoV-2 can cause GI infections as well. And so that's why sometimes diarrhea is associated with this coronavirus. And so a virus's ability to jump host from its natural reservoir to other species is really a product of, does it have the right key to fit into locks that are carried by different hosts? And is there opportunity for it to get out of its natural reservoir and into a different host? And that's really an important point right there for this whole conversation, is how do these viruses emerge? It's because of activities that people do. It's human activities that change the environment around us and bring us and our livestock into closer contact with wildlife. What's happening now more than ever in history is that the human population is at an all-time high and growing. We're putting incredible pressure on natural systems. We're deforesting, we're clearing land for agriculture, we're moving our livestock and ourselves closer to what were formerly pristine habitats. And so there's more opportunity to make contact with species that we haven't traditionally had contact with. We're starting to learn that bats seem to be particularly adept at tolerating viral infection. And that would explain why that they're able to carry so many different types of viruses.
And does it have to do with the fact that they're the only mammal that flies?
That's been a hypothesis that's developing, and it turns out that bats handle viral infection differently than other mammals. When we get infected with a virus, part of our body's response is inflammation. That's part of our fever response. It's part of our body's way of sending white blood cells to attack that virus. And the result is we have inflammation internally. And sometimes that's part of the disease process. Our own body's response can cause tissue damage, in extreme cases, organ failure. So that can be, you know, a really important process. Bats, along the way, somehow have lost some of the genes that are responsible for inflammation. So when a bat gets infected with a virus, it virtually doesn't develop any noticeable disease. Mm. Now, that's not always true, but it's generally true that bats tend to get very mild or no disease when they're carrying viruses like Nipah virus or relatives of Ebola virus. Now, the hypothesis is that this coincides with the evolution of flight. bats are the only mammals that have powered flight. And the process of flying, of flapping those wings, sometimes hundreds of times a minute, is incredibly stressful at the cellular level in the body. It can cause oxidative damage, which damages cells and the DNA inside cells. And to cope with that, bats have evolved to have mechanisms that dampen the immune response to that stress, to that physiologic exertion. And that might be why they don't also have inflammation when they're infected with viruses.
Wow. In some ways, it's just remarkable to think about the virus having evolved to the point where it's so, so dangerous to people. It's remarkable, right? I mean, that the virus would have everything it needed to be able to transmit so effectively between people and cause such severe disease.
It's a lot like, imagine the lottery balls. This is big, you know, the balls with numbers on them, and you turn the wheel and one ball comes out. Think of viruses that way. There's an enormous spectrum of viruses, all slight variations on a theme. And most of those may never have the ability to jump out of their natural host and infect other species. And it's the ones that do, the few that do, that we notice because they cause trouble.
Do you see bats as dangerous in any way or more as a beautiful animal?
No, the most dangerous thing about these bats is us tripping and falling in the cave when we're walking in there. Bats are, you know, they're a maligned animal, unfortunately, have a really bad reputation, but they're the most important animals in the world to people for so many reasons. Insect-eating bats provide incredible amounts of pest control. They eat moths and beetles that can damage crops by the ton. They eat mosquitoes. And then fruit-eating bats play an important role as pollinators and seed dispersers. In fact, half of the rainforest in the old world, in Africa and Asia, exists because of bats pollinating and dropping seeds. So without bats, we'd be in a lot of trouble. So no, I think they're terrific animals.
Well, John, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
That was Jonathan Epstein, a disease ecologist, and he spoke with Carolyn Cormon. You can find her article from Bats to Human Lungs at newyorker.com.